ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
Good morning, Valley Forge, King of Prussia, Greater Philadelphia, and everybody connecting to us via the Internet. Welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters, and it does. I'm your host, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. If you want to find out more about what CLI does, check us out at our website, www.constitutionleadership.org. We have our regular team here this morning, Pastor David Whitney, Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution in Pasadena, Maryland, and Phil Duffy, Instructor of the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at Widener University. Russ Orler and Al Locke are making things happen in the studio as usual. I want to mention that I really appreciate our sponsors, Valley Forge PC Repair, ShopRite Food Store, and We the People T-shirts. We couldn't bring this information to you without them. If you're in the Valley Forge area, I'd appreciate it if you'd support the first two sponsors, and anybody listening can go online and purchase a We the People T-shirt. I have We the People T-shirts with quotes by Franklin, George Washington, and Ronald Reagan, and there are several sayings I feel people should see and read frequently. I wear my shirts all the time. Get one and help spread the word that the founders had some really neat things to say. If you've tuned in the recent past, you know we are examining America's fundamental principles, principles that unfortunately have been pretty much forgotten, certainly not taught in our public schools, but which are the bedrock of this country's success. You cannot understand America without understanding these principles. So far, we've looked at the principle of self-government, the principle of equality under the law, the principle of unalienable rights, the principle that the power of government is derived from the people through their consent, and today we take up the topic of republicanism. Now, republicanism has nothing to do with the Republican Party. In fact, if you're worried that this will become some sort of a partisan advertisement, I'll put those fears at rest. For the first time since we started this series, we're going to depart this morning briefly from our trusty guide, the Declaration of Independence. We've derived all of the principles we've talked about so far from Mr. Jefferson's wonderful document. Jefferson did not analyze the various forms of government in the Declaration. That wasn't his purpose, of course. Each of the colonies was already largely operating under Republican principles by 1776. So in that summer, as new state constitutions were being drafted at the behest of Congress, what emerged were 13 free and independent republics, bound together in a firm league of friendship, otherwise known as a confederation. The bigger question would come 11 years later, when it had become clear that the confederation was on the verge of unraveling. What was going to emerge from the Constitutional Convention of 1787, a monarchy or a republic? And of course, good Dr. Franklin answered the question for us as he stepped out of the Pennsylvania State House. He said, "A republic, madam," he told an inquisitive lady, "if you can keep it." So today we're going to look at that, what distinguishes a republic, and how on earth do we keep it. As normal, we'll be taking your calls in the second half of the show, so if any of our commentators say anything that you want to challenge or would like clarified, please give us a call at 610-539-TALK, at 610-539-8255, or 610-539-1783 or 1784. I'm going to start this morning by asking Phil Duffy to begin our discussion. Phil told me in an email earlier this week that this is one of his favorite topics, so I can't wait to hear what he has to say. Let's get right to it. Phil, what does a republic consist of, and why don't we have a democracy as many Americans suppose we do?
Good morning, Gary.
Morning.
I find the dictionary definitions of democracy and republic to be misleading. According to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, a democracy is a form of government in which people choose leaders by voting. The corresponding definition for a republic is a country that is governed by elected representatives and by an elected leader, such as a president, rather than by a king or queen. So if we were to believe the Merriam-Webster Dictionary definition, a republic is simply not a monarchy, a monarchy. So a democracy and a republic could be the same form of government. The two terms would be synonyms. Then why is it that the Constitution requires the federal government to respect each state as a republic? And there are 10 separate essays in the Federalist that refer to democracy, but you would have to look long and hard to find any positive mention of the concept. Perhaps none deal with the differences between democracy and republic better than Madison number 10. But before exploring that, I'd like to mention an insight into the Constitution provided by Gary Wills in his introduction to the edition of the Federalist Papers. Wills identifies five themes that underlie the Constitution. Federalism, or the idea that the states as individual republics give up an enumerated part of their sovereignty to a federal entity, the United States of America. Checks and balances, or the idea of a bicameral legislative body, Congress. Separation of powers among the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government, but also between the federal government and the states. Pluralism, the encouragement of different experiments in government among those states, the state republics, so that the best ideas of government might emerge, but also to diminish the concentration of power in a national government. And finally, the idea of representation. This is why those dictionary definitions are so inadequate. They focus on one-fifth of the nature of republican government, representation. It is necessary to see how all of the parts operate together to understand the nature of government under which we live. So once we have that view, we are able to work our way through Madison's 18th century language in his number 10 Federalist essay when he says, "No man is allowed to be a judge in his own cause, because his interests would certainly bias his judgment and not improbably corrupt his integrity. With equal, nay, with greater reason, a body of men are unfit to be both judges and parties at the same time. Yet what are many of the most important acts of legislation, but so many judicial determinations, not indeed concerning the rights of single persons, but concerning the rights of large bodies of citizens? And what are the different classes of legislators, but advocates and parties to the causes which they determine?" Madison continues by describing the inherent weakness of democracy. Those in the majority will tend to employ government to infringe on the natural rights of those who are in the minority. Thomas Jefferson stated it more succinctly. "A democracy is nothing more than mob rule, where 51% of the people may take away the rights of the other 49. A republic, then, is not just a form of representative government in which the executive is not a monarch. It is a form of representative government in which constraints are placed upon all branches of government to govern within the limits of the rule of law. But what is the rule of law? The Oxford English Dictionary defines the rule of law in this way: the authority and influence of law in society, especially when viewed as a constraint on individual and institutional behavior. Hence, the principle whereby all members of a society, including those in government, are considered equally subject to publicly disclosed legal codes and processes." Unfortunately, our brethren across the Atlantic appear to have the same challenges with definitions as we do. That definition doesn't seem to get us to the essence of the rule of law. I prefer the Foundation for Economic Freedom's description. Let me quote from their site, which build on John Law's view of the law. I'm sorry, on John Locke's view of the law. The Lockean understanding of laws, and a pretty good litmus test of any proposed legislation today, is that laws must enlarge on individual freedom. Laws do this best when they are, and we get a list here, simple rules, evolved over time, agreed upon and known by all, rarely changed, and applied equally to all people. Enduring constitutions meet these criteria, and they are the foundation for the rule of law in those nations that adopt them. Our Constitution may be the best example of an enduring constitution because it generally meets these criteria. Notice that I'm not saying that our Constitution is a perfect document. How we might modify it would occupy us for several weeks on this program. John Locke also mentioned that where there is no law, there is no freedom. So let's play devil's advocate, John Locke's thought here. Forget the idea of pure anarchy. That happens so rarely that it's not worth exploring. Instead, let's talk about the situation where there is plenty of human law, but that law conflicts with the criteria we've just discussed. Put another way, let's talk about human law that conflicts with the natural law and revealed law. The best example of that is the Nuremberg Laws that were enacted in 1935 by Hitler's regime. We'd have to admit these laws weren't overly complex. However, they hadn't evolved over time, although anti-Semitism had been around Germany for many centuries. The laws represented a remarkable break with the tradition of Western civilization, a mere 2 years after the Nazis came to power. They certainly were not agreed upon and known by all, or applied equally to all citizens, because this was the classic case of a minority, Jewish Germans, being denied their rights by the majority. Finally, it is impossible to call these infamous laws rarely changed. They were enacted in 1935, and they were revoked by the occupying powers in 1945. Let's reflect on how inadequate the concept of representation alone is in defining the differences between democracy and a republic. We are conditioned by our educational system to think of Nazi Germany as the opposite to our system of representative government. How many of us, however, are aware that Hitler came to power through a democratic process, the March 1933 elections? How many of us understand that the Reichstag, the legislative body of the German Reich, continued to exist as a representative body until Nazi Germany was defeated? So Nazi Germany had elected representatives during the Nazi period, and it certainly wasn't governed by a king or a queen. Did that make Nazi Germany a republic? Okay, you could argue that Nazi Germany was governed by one man, Adolf Hitler. But an argument could also be made that during several periods of our nation's history, one party controlled both executive and legislative branches. What separated us during those periods from the kind of dictatorship experienced in Germany during the Nazi era? My point is that representation tells us almost nothing about the actual operation of modern governments. The real difference is the rule of law versus the rule of men. The distinguishing characteristic of a republic is the rule of law. In the United States, the foundation of the rule of law is our Constitution.
Well, thanks, Bill. So we have government by representatives and the rule of law as two features of republicanism. There are others, as you know, and which I'll mention later, but that's a good start. Let me turn now to David Whitney. David, Bill showed us there are some rather muddied definitions out there on the Internet which seem to be designed to make democracy sound like a republic. That sounds like a conspiracy to me. Who would want us to think we live in a democracy rather than a republic? But before you answer that, We both know there were founders other than Jefferson who had some pretty strong things to say about democracies. Can you enlighten us on that and perhaps talk about Article 4 in the Constitution, where, as Phil mentioned, a Republican form of government is guaranteed to every state? Why did the founders put that in, and what's that mean?
Oh, thank you so much, Gary, and appreciate the comments that Phil has added to our understanding here. If we were to boil it down to its essence, the question is, what is the source of authority? And the source of authority in a republic is a standard of law that is above and beyond the reach of man. Really, our founders said that standard is the laws of nature, nature's God, on which our Declaration was founded, on which our Constitution was constructed, which takes us right back to the God of the universe, the creator of all things. He's the one that established what true law is, and a republic, particularly a Christian constitutional republic, which our founders spoke of that they were creating, that this goes back to his law as supreme authority, and nobody can change that or alter that. In a democracy, however, the authority comes from 51% of the people that vote. So as Phil said, like in Nazi Germany, if you have a majority of the people say, hey, yeah, take the Jews to the concentration camps, we're fine with that, that's fine, then that becomes the source of authority. So our founders, therefore, said it was a very dangerous thing to have a democracy. For example, James Madison in that same Federalist Paper number 10 said, hence it is that democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and in general have been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. A republic, by which I mean a government in which a scheme of representation takes place, opens a different prospect and promises the cure for which we are seeking. And by the way, they had just at the same time period an ongoing illustration of what a democracy looks like with the French Revolution. There, heads were rolling left and right based on no standard of law other than what the mob wanted. And mob rule is indeed what our founders described democracy as. Thomas Jefferson used that. And John Adams also said, remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. Wow, most people have never heard our founders talk like this about democracies. And Benjamin Franklin, I think he put it in a very cute and effective kind of parable. He said, a democracy is two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch. And he continues, liberty is a well-armed lamb contesting the vote. There's a guarantee of our Second Amendment rights, because if the lamb is well-armed, he could defend himself against the two wolves who are voting to eat him for lunch, or to take his property, or whatever they might want to do to violate his God-given rights. So this is essential to understand. What's the source of authority in a republic, particularly in our republic, founded on the laws of nature and nature's God? We look to the Creator and his law that is supreme. No human law can violate his law and be valid. In a republic, that is the case, but in a democracy, it is 51% of the people that go to the polls that determine what is right or what is wrong. Now, given what our founders believe, the question is, how in the world did we move from that understanding to today? Talk to the average person. If they, Phil and Gary, you both know this from personal experience. You ask a person, what form of government do we have? And they give you a blank stare, or the most likely response is they're going to say, we are a democracy. In fact, it was not too long ago, 1928, the War Department, in its training manual by which in boot camp and following, the members of the military were trained. And this is what it says in that training manual, lesson number 9. It says, a democracy is a government of the masses, authority derived through mass meetings or any other form of direct expression, and it results in a mobocracy. Attitude towards property is communistic. Notice what they're teaching in 1928. Democracy and communism are related because the attitude towards property is communistic. That is, we all own all the property, and if 51% of us say we're going to take somebody's property, we can do that. So the attitude toward property is communistic, negating property rights. The attitude towards law is that the will of the majority shall regulate, whether it be based upon deliberation or governed by passion, prejudice, or impulse, without restraint or regard to consequences. And this results in demagogism, license, agitation, discontent, and anarchy. But we're all told, and most of us sadly have believed, that we're a democracy. You hear it repeated endlessly by the politicians and the schools. If they teach anything about our government, they tell the children it's a democracy, in spite of the fact that every day when they say the Pledge of Allegiance, they say we are a republic. And as Phil has illustrated, there is an attempt to confuse and mix the two terms together so that people don't know the difference, or people think they're one and the same. There's no difference. Our founder said quite the opposite. So the question is, why would someone do that? Well, I think in that training manual there in 1928, it's clear that if you want to impose communism, you have to start moving people in that direction, and you do so by teaching them, oh, it's all a democracy. And it's fascinating. These manuals, Army manuals containing those definitions, were ordered destroyed without explanation at the same time that President FDR made private ownership of our lawful money, that is constitutional money, gold coins. He made ownership of gold coins illegal and proceeded to steal the American people's wealth and loot our nation's wealth, and at the same time destroying that definition. And if they taught anything about it, they no longer taught in that that vein. So you can see where this heads. And what we need to understand is that to recover an understanding, it means to get back to our founder's worldview of law and government. And by the way, if folks are interested, in January, we're going to be teaching a course, our U.S. Constitution course. You don't have to make the trip to Pasadena, Maryland. You can actually view it online. And Michael Peruca and myself will be lecturers for that live course Thursday evening starting January 21st. Just go to our website, theamericanview.com, theamericanview.com, and sign up, because we need to educate ourselves. Then we need to educate our children, our friends, our family, our circle of influence. We need to educate our churches that our founders had a worldview of law and government that's radically different from what we are told today. And to restore that, we've got to get back to the understanding that we are not a democracy, but we are a republic. And the significant differences, I know, Gary, you're going to talk about the teaching of Scott Whiteman, who is one of the lecturers as part of our series at Institute on the Constitution, of the seven elements of a republic that distinguish it from a democracy. When we have these understandings, then we have a foundation by which to tell others we're not a democracy. How would you like to be the one lamb in a gathering of wolves voting on who's going to, or what's going to be for lunch? You know that you're going to be on the menu. Your rights are never secure in a democracy, because there is no higher authority than 51% of the people that go to the polls and happen to vote. And we know that in our day we have people in the White House who believe redistribution of wealth is the mandate that's been given to them by 51% of the people who voted for them, put them in office. So they believe they have the authority to steal the property of other people, redistribute it as they see fit, because they believe in a democracy, and they believe that democracy has given them the authority to do that. Our Constitution gives them no such authority and no such power, and they have a false view, but they're elected. Because imagine if you have a society in which 51% of the people are receiving benefits that are stolen from the 49% of the people and put into their pockets, whether by welfare checks or grants or whatever kind of program from the government you want to call it. Let's just call it what it is. It's theft, taking the property from the 49% and giving it to the 51%. What are the 51% going to vote for every time they go to the polls? They're going to vote for more money out of the pockets of the 49% into the pockets of the 51%. So you have a mob rule, and you have a what you might call a kleptocracy, not a republic, not a democracy, but a kleptocracy, which is government of the thieves and government by the thieves and government for the thieves. That's what a democracy is, which is why our founders did not want to have a democracy at all.
Well, that's a good wrap-up, and we will be right back after these commercial breaks to finish up our discussion of republicanism. Don't go away.
Radio. I'm Lillian Wu. The president heads to San Bernardino, California today
to console the families of the victims of that attack.
Press Secretary Josh Earnest. Afterward, the president will head to Hawaii to start his vacation.
On Capitol Hill, Congress continues to question the administration on its vetting procedures for visas. In that hearing, the government said the U.S. had revoked 9,500 visas since 2001 because of terror concerns. Lawmakers are also pushing investigators to examine social media before granting visas to enter the United States, though FBI Director James Comey has said the San Bernardino shooters communicated privately online about martyrdom.
Fox's Rich Edson, a court appearance today for the Chicago police officer accused of murder in the death of the teen. Prosecutors say he shot 16 times. And the Vatican says Pope Francis has approved the miracle needed to make Mother Teresa a saint. Fox News, we report. You decide.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
Hey, Grandma, can you help me with my Common Core lesson on the Constitution? I know you always said how important it is, but the only part we're reading in 8th grade is the preamble and the First Amendment. I wonder when we'll get to study the rest of it. Didn't you say our founding fathers were wise patriots and wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to protect our freedom? This Common Core book we're reading by Linda Monk says our founding fathers were racist and they didn't think women or blacks should ever be allowed to vote. She says, we the people, didn't really mean you and me, but some rich white guys. That just makes me feel terrible about our country. We need to change things.
Oh, honey, that's not true at all. Our country is the greatest country the world has ever seen, and our founding fathers worked hard to be fair to everyone. I'm going to call our school board and our state board of education and ask why they allow Common Core and this book in your school.
Call your representatives now and ask them to stop Common Core and restore local control. Pennsylvanians for Restoring Education brought you this message. Go to parestoringeducation.org or call 484-678-2236.
Welcome back to We the People, the Constitution Matters. If you're just joining us, we are examining republicanism, small r republicanism, including what constitutes a republic and why it is to be preferred over a democracy and what Ben Franklin, for one, would have us do to keep this republic alive. In a few minutes, we'll be taking your phone calls on 610-539-8255. 1783 or 1784, so have those numbers handy. First-time callers will receive a pocket constitution. These words should be familiar, and David alluded to them, and to the republic for which it stands. Of course, those come out of our Pledge of Allegiance, and it's amazing to see the number of Americans who, after reciting the Pledge of Allegiance all their lives, still insist that we live in a democracy. Tuesday of this week, I had
I went to one of my local malls, and I handed out free pocket constitutions in honor of Bill of Rights Day. Way back in 1791, on December 15th, that was the day that the Bill of Rights went into effect when Virginia ratified 10 of the 12 amendments that Congress had proposed to the state. I asked a dozen or so people what form of government we have in America, and only one came up with the right answer. Most seemed to have no idea what I was even talking about. It was also a bit scary seeing so many people who had no idea who represented them in Congress. If representative government is one of the main features of a republic, well, we might have still the form of republicanism, but we seem to have lost the spirit of republicanism. As we search for other features of republic, we get some help from an essay by Scott Whiteman that David alluded to. It's entitled, What is a Republic Anyway? And you can find it posted to IOTC's website and other places on the web. According to Scott Whiteman, there are seven essential characteristics of the American Republic. He finds these characteristics laid out in the Federalist Papers, and Hamilton mentioned some of them in six different Federalist Papers, and Madison mentions other features in Federalist 39 and 47. These features include, first, separation of powers. We'll talk more about that when we get to constitutionalism in this series, so I won't spend any time on it today in detail. But the idea of separation of powers is mentioned in four different Federalist essays. Government by representatives who have either defined terms or, in the case of judges, serve during good behavior. There's the case of representation that we've talked about. That's mentioned in Federalist 39 and 39. Last week, we discussed the idea that government derives its power from the people. Well, Madison identifies that as a feature of a republic in Federalist 39, and it bears elaboration. In a democracy where the people exert their political power directly, it's obvious where the power originates. There's really no question about it. But in a republic where we send folks to Washington or to our state capitals to represent us, the distance that that creates makes it easy to forget that the people still retain and remain the source of government's power. So that is something we have to consider and remember. Whiteman says also that another feature of a republic is where the government is deliberative in action. Hamilton mentions this in Federalist 71. The legislature, we know, in Congress, follows rules. There's debate. Voting follows several forms and relies on certain percentages. All very deliberative. In fact, the charge is often made of Congress that it is too deliberative and doesn't get anything done. They are often accused of being all words and no action. In Federalist 84, Hamilton identifies the republic as a government that prohibits further grants of entitlement or nobility. And we see this spelled out in Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8 of the Constitution, as well as the ill-fated original 13th Amendment. And finally, Whiteman contends that that republicanism is a system that acknowledges the right of the people to alter or abolish the government whenever it becomes destructive towards the ends for which it was instituted. Madison talks about this in several of his personal letters, and Hamilton mentions it in Federalist 78. So there's a start on what constitutes a republic. But besides these features, which we find laid out in the Federalist Papers, we know that the founders had other things to say about this form of government, and they wrote voluminous letters. Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1816 that the true foundation of republican government is the equal right of every citizen in his person and property and in their management. Sounds like a lot of, sounds like a kind of a rewrite of the Declaration of Independence in a sense. In 1776, John Adams wrote to Mercy Warren. He said, public virtue is the only foundation of republics. There must be a positive passion for the public good, the public interest, honor, power, and glory established in the minds of the people, or there can be no republican government, nor any real liberty. And this public passion must be superior to all private passions. So there's two features there. You have to have equal rights, and you have to have public virtue. Neither of those, of course, mentioned in the Federalist Papers. John Witherspoon signed the Declaration of Independence. Before that, He was James Madison's professor at what would eventually be called Princeton University. Witherspoon added, "A republic must either preserve its virtue or lose its liberty." So once again, we see a connection between virtue in the people and the success of a republic. Let's talk for a moment about what Ben Franklin might have had in mind when he said, "If you can keep it." What does keeping a republic require? If there's one thing that Americans seem oblivious of, besides who represents them in Congress, it is that a republic requires this keeping. Americans seem to think that America will exist forever as a free republic. If they think that and continue to act that way, I think they're in for a rude awakening. One couple that I interviewed Tuesday was convinced that we are headed for some rough times as a nation. Civil unrest would be, to put it mildly. We are deeply divided as a people into two basic camps. David alluded to this. One that insists that government should take care of them, and one that insists equally strongly that government should get out of the way and let them live their lives. This divide is growing, and at some point there will have to be a reconciliation of these two opposing viewpoints. Unfortunately, good Dr. Franklin didn't elaborate on what would serve to keep the republic, so we have to kind of glean that for ourselves. In previous quotes I mentioned, we can see that insisting on the equal right of every citizen in the management of their person and property is important, and insisting upon public virtue and maintaining a passion for the public good is equally important. In his 1832 History of the United States, Noah Webster said that preservation of republican government depends on the faithful discharge of the right to vote, which he went on to say meant electing just men who will rule in the fear of God, quoting Scripture. Having representatives with the fear of God was important to Webster and should be equally important to us. Webster also knew, and he wrote, that men in republics are as wicked, as selfish as in monarchies, and with far more power to introduce disorders, both into legislation and into the administration of the laws. So it's incredibly important that we select our representatives with care and then monitor them with equal care. If these gentlemen were right, and I think they were, then that is a charge to us. Only a little more than half of the voting age public in this country, about 55%, voted in the 2012 presidential election. Still worse, only 36% turned out in the most recent midterm election. That is simply pathetic. I've read that only 50% of evangelical Christians in America are even registered to vote, and then only half of them do vote, which means that only about 25% of the evangelical viewpoint is represented in elections. You get what you vote for, folks, or what you don't vote for, whichever way you want to look at it. Sam Adams said each citizen should remember at the moment he is offering his vote that he is not making a present or a compliment to please an individual, or at least that he ought not to do so, but that he is executing one of the most solemn trusts in human society for which he is accountable to God and his country. If only Americans felt they were accountable to God for how they voted. Making this worse is the fact that some Americans who do vote should probably stay home instead. Some put no more thought into this than whether there's a D or an R beside a name. One young lady that I interviewed on Tuesday said she always votes, and I quote, "for whoever my dad tells me to vote for." That's just great. A friend, Hank Sims, down here where I live, has written a book called America's Plan for Survival, in which he lays out many changes that he would make if he could. One would be to bring back the poll test. He would make every American pass the U.S. citizenship test that we administer to aliens seeking U.S. citizenship. In other words, if you don't know enough to become a citizen, you don't get to vote. That makes sense to me. In fact, I'd like to hear from our listeners whether they would support having a one-time poll test restored as mandatory in this country. I hope they will call in. I know we have got one on hold as we speak. So, are we still a republic today? Well, there's a book, written by Jay Koss, in which he entitled A Republic No More. And, of course, the title says it all. He says, no, we are no longer a republic. He argues that generation after generation has altered the design of our government in subtle but important ways without considering the effect on the broader schema. The Constitution's checks and balances have broken down because the institutions created in 1787 cannot exercise responsibly the powers of our sprawling, immense 21st century government. So if Koss is right, republic no more, then we've got some rebuilding to do. So either way you look at it, we've either got keeping or rebuilding. In other words, we've got work that the American people should take up. So let's go to our callers. We've got Claude Dunn from Fredericksburg, Virginia on the line. Claude, good morning. What do you want to add to our discussion this morning?
Well, good morning, Gary. I've certainly heard more about a Republican form of government than I have heard on any radio station in the nation since I've been alive, and that's been here for 74 years, so that's saying
something.
Well, thank you. This is an outstanding program. I can't commend you enough for it. When teaching classes on the Constitution, I often refer to a Republican form of government, try to simplify it so the students can pick up on it, is the fact that Republican form of government is limited to exercising no more power and authority than we as individuals have to the representatives in government. And this goes back to the idea that we get our right to life where God says thou shalt not murder. We get our right to liberty, as you know, and God says thou shalt not steal and so forth. We're limited by God's higher moral law, and we only have a right. Of course, given as our collective rightful use of force, we only have a right to use force to protect life, liberty, and property in a general, broad sense. So, therefore, the actions and functions that we can delegate to our representatives in government are very limited. And people just at this simple step seem to they can't quite put their arms around it and grab that this is the limitation on government. The government can't do anything that being moral or wrong for them to use force to do. And certainly this is the great divide in the discussion on a constitutional convention. How many of the folks calling for a constitutional convention truly understand this limitation of a Republican form of government? It's a very scary proposition to think that we had this great system of government that was given to us by our founders to secure our rights, that the people that are advocating for it, pro, con, whatever, most of them don't understand this fundamental of Republican form of government. And I think this radio program should be a must listen to before anybody would start any kind of discussion on modifying or recommending amendments to our Constitution. I think the founding fathers.
Well, Claude, if I could interrupt for
right
a moment, I want to point out that all of our shows are
for everything that y'all have said this morning.
Put in the
thank
podcast
you for your work.
Area. So, if somebody missed the live show, they can go on, download it, and listen later at their leisure. Go ahead. Claude, are you still there?
Yes, you're breaking up on the phone. I'm having a hard time hearing what you're saying. What was the last question?
Well, I just mentioned that we do have podcasts of these shows available for download on the WFYL's website. So if people miss the live show, they can download it and listen to the shows later time. So go ahead.
Yes, that is a fantastic feature to your program that we can download them. And what knowledge is there in a very condensed form on these various subjects? People would do themselves a great service to get into the website and download every one of your programs. They're fantastic and very educational. They're going to hear things that they've never heard anywhere else, I'm sure. I've taken a lot of courses on the Constitution, and this kind of discussion I have yet to hear anywhere else. Wouldn't it be great if the politicians actually discuss these sort of things when they're running for office and would educate the public? Like you said, we definitely need a test on constitutional knowledge before anybody is allowed to vote.
So you would support then a poll test or the reinstitution of a poll test. And, of course, there is nothing in the Constitution that prohibits it. It doesn't. The Constitution doesn't prohibit a poll test. It only prohibits a poll tax. So, would you be in favor of instituting something like that?
Absolutely. You know, we need some sort of citizenship test for everybody when they reach the age of voting to see if they can be a full-fledged citizen. If they don't understand these things, how are they going to maintain a system of government that they don't have a clue as to how it works? Like you say, if they think anything, they think we're a democracy.
How about David and Phil? Phil, do you think we ought to reinstitute a poll test?
Oh, absolutely. I agree. There seems to be a mysticism in democracy. We could look at an individual voter who is totally ignorant of the principles of the Constitution and the heritage of the nation, and we would say that person should be kept away from the polls. Everybody would agree with that. That's logical. However, the mystical part of it is that somehow if we extend the vote to everybody, that by aggregating the ignorance of one person to millions, somehow we have achieved wisdom in government. I don't get it.
Yeah. David,
would you
vote for a poll test?
Yes, I would. What would be helpful is to think of it in this context. Why don't we let four-year-olds vote? I mean, if we really believe the franchise of voting ought to be available to everyone, why not four-year-olds, you know? After all, they are persons, and if we're just saying, based on the fact that you're a living, breathing human being, you should be able to vote, why not four-year-olds? Well, most people say, well, that doesn't make sense. Four-year-olds don't have enough knowledge. They don't have enough wisdom. Aha, yes, and that's exactly what's the problem with most of the voters today. And so that's really why Institute on the Constitution exists, to help educate the citizens as to what our form of government is. In fact, I would support not only a course, but a test, and I appreciate some friends who've drawn up questions out of our course, 50 questions that really are essential. If a person can't pass that test, or at least with a 90% grade on that test, then they need to go back and retake the course and relearn what they missed so that they get it right. So, yes, I would be in favor of that. In fact, I know that those of us just on the radio show right here together could put together such a test that would guard our liberties. And that's, I think, the essential thing we need to remember. What happens at the polling place, what happens in the voting booth, is either going to guard our God-given liberties or destroy our God-given liberties. It's going to go one direction or the other. You vote a tyrant who wants to redistribute wealth, you're going to lose your right to property in that game, and therefore you can't allow people into that polling booth who are going to be committed to stealing from other people, people who are not committed to maintaining the laws of nature and nature's God.
So the next question would be then, if we all generally support a poll test, should it be a one-time event, that is, to qualify you as a voter, or should it be annually? Every time you enter the polling area, should you be given this test to prove that you are still capable as a citizen of voting responsibly? What are your opinions on that?
I would tend towards the annual, and for this reason. Think about how important it is to protect your God-given rights of life, liberty, and property, and so on. Contrast that with, say, your doctor. When you go to the medical doctor, do you want to be sure that he's updated, that the treatment he's going to prescribe for you, or if he's going to do surgery, maybe he's going to open up your back and make some repair on your spinal column, you know, you want to be sure that guy is very good at what he does. And so we have continuing education for doctors and continuing education for other professions because we want them to be at the top of their game. So I would advocate for that. We need people who are at the top of their game in protecting our God-given rights.
Well, let's start with your 50-question test then at IOTC as the starting point. Let's propose this poll test, send it up to our representatives, and see if we can get this passed through Congress. Let me go ahead and summarize. We've got about 4 minutes left. Let me summarize what we've agreed on today and what we've heard. Small R republicanism is a set of principles that the founders knew well. They knew that once these principles were embedded into a design of government,
that the principles would produce the greatest amount of individual freedom and thus the greatest potential for prosperity of any governmental system. They wished to guarantee these principles, called a republican form of government, to every new state admitted to the Union. These principles are a structure of representative government instead of a democracy, separation of powers among the branches of government, a system of checks and balances that would avoid the accumulation of power in any one branch, the rule of law, an acknowledgement that political power originates in the people and is delegated to government for express purposes, and ever lurking in the background, an acknowledgement that the people retain the right to reform their government if it should ever become oppressive. These are the principles of republicanism. To embrace them, you need not join a political party. You need only realize their essential quality. They are essential for a people to remain free and able to chart their own course in life. The founders also realized, however, that these principles could be compromised, that there is nothing permanent about them, and that a virtuous people were necessary to keep them in place, a people willing to remain vigilant to usurpations of power and subtle changes in the design of government that would serve to weaken these principles. This is the keeping of the republic that Franklin charged us with. America is in great danger of losing the republic that the founders fought so hard to give us. The signs are not hard to find. As John Stuart Mill's warned, if we are not willing to fight for our right to remain a free people, we are unfit for liberty. I do want to mention next week on Christmas Day and then again on New Year's Day, you'll hear repeats of two of our fundamental shows while our broadcast team spends some well-deserved time with our families. On December 29th, I'll be going in for some long overdue back surgery, as David unknowingly alluded to there. I appreciate your prayers. On Friday, 8th January in 2016, amazing, a new year is about to hit us, we will take up the subject of constitutionalism and the principles that we find built into the United States Constitution. I hope you'll join us. That will be an incredibly important show to hear. On Monday night, January 11th, from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Foundation for American Christian Education, you can hear Gayron Totherov speak on the subject of media bias, distorting truth, science, and polar bears. That will be an intriguing topic, and you can go to www.face.net to register for that, either in the classroom or via live stream. David mentioned on January 21st, IOTC begins a new Constitution course. So another opportunity to learn more about our government and how it should function. Let me close by saying in Federalist 10, James Madison wrote, "A republic, by which I mean a government in which the scheme of representation takes place, opens a different prospect and promises the cure for which we are seeking," and I can add then, "to the problem of faction." It does, but a key element is the structure of government laid down by the framers. If you start tinkering with that structure, and if the people don't remain virtuous, that design of government will no longer work to restrain the effects of faction. And that's what we have today. A republic requires care and feeding people. Voting is a great first step, but insufficient in and of itself. If you want America to remain a republic, you have to be willing to fight for it. Or as John Stuart Mill suggests, you may be found unfit for liberty. Download a podcast of the show and send it to your congressman. See what he thinks. Are you willing to fight to keep America a republic? If not you, then who? If not now, then when? See you next time on We the People, the Constitution Matters. Bring new to the discussion.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mention WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.